We thought we were going to have finance here to answer some questions today, but they're a little bit busy, so you don't have them. not the best day to ask them to come. Okay, would you please introduce yourselves? And
good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota University. And with me is John Osmussen, who is the Executive Director of our Office of Internal Auditing. So with your permission, I'll proceed to respond to the request that we received. I want to thank you very much for inviting us here to talk with you today about the work that we do. It's been some years since I appeared before the state government division, and in those years, ordinarily, I was getting yelled at. So this is a nice change.
I've been following. See what happens when you're responsible for something we don't have any responsibility for.
Well, I just had a different role in those years. I've been following the work of this committee, and I want to commend you for the attention that you've paid to this issue. Your committee has a powerful role to play in supporting and encouraging the culture of excellence in financial management. Minnesota has a long and honorable history in this area, outstanding public administration, and you're wise to cherish and defend that reputation. First, let me say that I'm honored that you would seek our input. The Board of Trustees, Chancellor McCormick, our 32 college and university presidents, and all of our finance and administration employees have invested substantial leadership and resources in creation and care of our financial management environment. Our organization is now 12 years old, and our spending on administrative services ranks 46th out of the 50 states. We leverage our own technology and the state's central accounting system and payroll system to deliver services to 390,000 students and 19,000 employees. Like all of state government, we are under extreme cost pressure and ever-rising service expectations. We're governed by a board of trustees appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. They hire the chief executive, Chancellor McCormick, and he hires all of the presidents. The board also appoints the executive director of internal auditing. We all work in support of the organization's strategic plan, which was conceived and approved by the board. The board also establishes all policies that govern our work. These policies include an expectation that every president will comply with and further the board's commitment to outstanding financial management across the system. Our program is modeled after the standards developed by the Treadway Commission in the mid-80s, which came to be referred to as the COSOL framework. It has five elements. I'm just going to walk briefly through them to give you some sense of how we've approached the subject of internal control. First and most importantly, and what your work here today is helping establish, is a tone at the top. Established in policy, communicated by my office, by the board, and by the chancellor regularly. The board established an audit committee in 1995 to monitor financial management. In early years, I would give awards for the worst financial data, for the worst financial management environment, and we have long ago transitioned those to awards for excellence. All part of a high profile, high attention effort to bring the presidents and their staff to bear on the subject of financial management and financial integrity. Presidents are accountable for the actions on their campus, and the results in this area are part of their annual review. The activity of internal control and financial management more generally needs a champion. It needs a high-level champion, someone who will fight for strong administrative capacity in a declining resource environment. There's tremendous pressure on our organization and on all the organizations that come before you to shave back office functions. You need to resist that, because when you start doing that, you start to degrade the environment, and your financial control environment will suffer very rapidly. The second element of the COSOL framework is risk assessment. This is where our contract with the Office of the Legislative Auditor comes into play. That has been a key part of our financial management strategy since 1996, when that contract was first executed. We have annual rotating campus reviews. The results are shared with all of the campuses, All of the presidents and their leadership are expected to read all of the audit reports that are issued by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Those have provided very strong training and teaching documents for us by design as part of our whole risk assessment and tone-setting strategy. The college and university staffing levels are a risk that I focus on, again, because there's great pressure to keep money, in our case, in the classroom. That pressure comes to bear on the capacity of the organization to maintain adequate financial management controls. We also prepare full financial statements for 12 of our largest colleges and universities and the entire system. These statements are audited annually by outside firms and again receive very high level attention by the chancellor and the board. Our strategy in this area is really twofold: financial assurance at the system level and internal control reviews annually for the colleges and universities. These assessments must be done regularly because the risk environment changes, processes change, and risks move around the organization. So it's not sufficient to do it once every 5 or 7 years. Technology changes, the roles change, and so we measure regularly accordingly. We have invested significant money in our relationship with the Office of the Legislative Auditor and with our outside auditors. And we do that very intentionally because we view them as an important hedge against risk in our environment. The third framework for COSOL is the control activities. We have continuous exception reporting processes for our key control areas across all the campuses. We have annual review of chart of accounts and activity accounting, and very carefully constructed rules for delegation for material activities. As your members no doubt know, we are a very decentralized organization, and we've been very thoughtful in designing the authority that we delegate to presidents and the authority that is reserved for the chancellor staff. And we do that with an eye toward internal control and risk mitigation. And then finally, we've paid a lot of attention over the years to data integrity, and we've aligned our allocation processes and our budget processes so that data integrity matters to the outcome of the work. If you make the data important to something that they care about, then they'll pay more attention to the data. The fourth element is information and communication, and I think there's a little bit of communication on this issue in the correspondence I saw between the committee and the Commissioner of Finance. We have a standard training cycle that we have run annually. We train on all the basic controls and processes. We share all the information across all of the campuses. We expect them to read it and be accountable for it, even if it wasn't generated on their campus. We bring all of this information to the board on a regular basis, so they're aware of it. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we have a widely advertised awards program to draw attention to those that are doing it well. The fifth element of the COSOL framework concerns monitoring, and this is really where this effort is hooked into the work of the Office of the Office of Internal Auditing. The board established this office in 1997 at the direction of the audit committee of the board, and the work of the office was given a very high profile by the chancellor and by the board. John and his staff work independently of the chancellor, report directly to the board, and are tasked with monitoring the results that come out of the audit process and corresponding with the campuses to assure that findings are resolved. He also corresponds, of course, with the chancellor, works with the campuses on remediation, and then reports annually to the chancellor and the board on the progress that the campuses have made in resolving their issues. I'd like to, if I might, turn to John here and give him an opportunity to talk about the Office of Internal Auditing as part of our larger financial management program, and then I'll come back and close.
Madam Chair, members, certainly a pleasure to be here with you today. I applaud you for taking on such a topic as internal controls. And
just
internal.
Say your name.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My name is John Osmussen. I'm the Executive Director of Internal Auditing for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I applaud you for taking on such a topic. It certainly gets me excited. It's my blood going to talk about accountability and internal control. And so you need a few of us like that around state government. Like Vice Chancellor King, it's been many years since I've been before your committee. I actually spent 21 years with the Legislative Auditor's Office, 15 of those I served as deputy legislative auditor most of that time for Mr. Nobles. And I left the legislative auditor in 1997. I was lured over by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to start an internal audit function for them. So I'm here today to tell you a little bit about our internal audit function at MinSCU, but also I come to you with substantial auditing experience that committee members may find useful. In addition to my 33 years of professional auditing, I have extensive experience in leadership roles with professional auditing and accounting associations like the Minnesota Society of CPAs, the Institute of Internal Auditors, and the State Board of Accountancy. So I'm happy to draw upon that experience today for members if you would find it to be useful. It is certainly fitting that Vice Chancellor King is here with me today and started our presentation to explain internal controls at MinSCU, because internal controls is a management responsibility, not an auditor responsibility. And Mr. Nobles made that point quite firmly with you when he was here last week. But I also wish to reiterate that from an internal audit standpoint. Under the right conditions, internal auditors can certainly affect improvement and strengthening of internal controls, but we cannot be the ones that manage them. That is an executive management responsibility. Similarly, I would suggest to you that you should not expect the Department of Finance to manage the internal controls of other state agencies. Finance can provide leadership and training and guidance to other agencies, but agency management must assume responsibilities for its own internal controls. And I'll come back to this point later, because I believe that the Department of Finance, in fact, is poised to play a very important role in this regard for state government. But this distinction between internal controls and internal auditing is very important for the committee members to understand. I know last week Representative Winkler was pressing Mr. Nobles on that very point to gain an understanding of where that distinction lies. Now, the Star Tribune in its Sunday headline article that fewer auditors leads to more fraud, something to that effect, suggests that there's a direct relationship between the number of auditors and the amount of fraud. Now, as I'm repeatedly reminded in my graduate school studies, a correlation does not equal causality. And so there's an intervening variable here between internal auditing and internal controls, and it's management. Management's attitude, resourcefulness, and commitment affect the quality of both internal controls and internal auditing, a point that Vice Chancellor King made to you quite strongly. But we recognize that management doesn't operate in a vacuum. And in the MinSCU environment, the Board of Trustees has a fairly prominent role in creating expectations on the part of management and setting standards for operational and financial management. And then clearly your committee serves an important role and serves as a force to set that tone for all of state government. Now, at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the Chancellor and the Board of Trustees together have established an uncompromising standard for internal auditing and internal controls. I shared with members today an article that was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education about 3 years ago, where Chancellor McCormick and former board chair at the time, Michael Bekich, really professed their strong conviction for creating an independent professional internal auditing operation. I will tell you that I would not be at MinSCU today if it wasn't for that kind of conviction. Any internal auditor worth their salt needs that kind of support from the governing board and their executive management in order to be successful. And so I come to you with the first lesson that I want to share with you today about internal auditing, and it's the lesson of positioning. Internal auditors, to be successful, must have a dual reporting channel to the chief executive and to the governing board. Now, at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, I report functionally to the chair of the audit committee, Trustee Scott Spitz, who some of you may know and be familiar with. And I report administratively to Chancellor McCormick to fulfill my dual reporting channel obligations. Chancellor McCormick invites me to attend his cabinet meetings and meetings of his leadership council, the presidents and senior administrators. And that positioning allows me to identify projects that may be aligned with the strategic priorities of the system, and so that I can set the scope to my audit and produce audit results without interference. In the Star Tribune article that appeared on Sunday, Mr. Nobles was quoted as saying, "We need people with a lack of deference to authority." It's a partial quote. But I will tell you that positioning of internal auditing is a way to achieve that result. We shouldn't be asking employees to be vigilantes and just be insubordinate to authority. But you need someone in the organization that is positioned and has the support to provide some independent viewpoint and voice. And internal auditing can do that. Now, if applying an internal auditing model to state government, though, produces some special challenges. The model works quite well in independent governing boards, like for MinSCU, the University of Minnesota, the Met Council. We all have internal auditing models that follow the corporate model. But the rest of state government is somewhat of a challenge. The optimal place to put an internal auditor, if state government were a corporate entity, the optimal place to put an internal auditor is the place that's occupied by the legislative auditor. That's typically where you would put an internal auditor. The problem was that state government introduces is a separation of powers. Mr. Noble's office is not able to carry out a dual channel of reporting to both the governor and to the legislature. So we have a bit of a problem to solve, and that is, how do we establish that reporting channel back up to our chief executive office or the governor? And there are some viable options for doing that. States like Virginia and North Carolina, I believe actually North Carolina in 2007 did a fairly extensive study in trying to put some accountability improvements into place in terms of internal controls and internal auditing. It may be a model you want to take a look at. But certainly the Department of Finance can play a role in fulfilling that channel, or other options could be pursued. But it's not my understanding that assignment has been given to the Commissioner of Finance at this point in time. I also want to make it clear to you that I don't recommend just going out and establishing internal audit departments in all state agencies. Internal auditing is a means to an end, not an end unto itself. The end game here is really effective internal control. And internal auditing operations work well for large, complex organizations like MinSCU, but it certainly wouldn't be a cost-effective solution for smaller agencies. Earlier in my testimony, I mentioned that the Department of Finance was poised to really provide some service in this area. It has established a policy on internal controls that contains many of the elements that Vice Chancellor King just reviewed with you. And it's in the process, it's my understanding that the department is in the process of developing some training and a certification process for agency heads as well as finance personnel. I would just urge you to encourage the Commissioner of Finance to put that plan into play. It would be part of the solution. I'll also tell you that it doesn't make much sense to have the Department of Finance serve as the internal auditor for the rest of state government. From the standpoint of a smaller agency, an auditor from the Department of Finance would look very much like a legislative auditor coming to visit them. It'd be someone from that's external from their organization. One of the strengths of internal auditing is we understand our operation. I mean, I understand student financial aid and post-secondary enrollment options programs and how our ISRS system works. I don't understand federal highway funding very well, but my colleagues in the Internal Audit Department and MnDOT do. You have to have that understanding of agency operations to truly be effective as an internal auditor. So that's the second really principle that I would tell you about internal auditing. The first was positioning of the audit function, and the second is making sure that there's an intimate working knowledge of the agency under audit. And there are two more elements to internal auditing that I'll mention to you today. One is having experienced professional staff, and the final one is to adhere to professional standards. And there are professional standards, well-established professional standards for internal auditing that I could certainly reference you to if you're interested. Now, just allow me to pull all four of these elements together and talk just a little bit about the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Office of Internal Auditing. I've given you a little brochure that shows a little bit about my office. We were created in 1997, as Vice Chancellor King indicated. There are 10 professional staff in my office. For those of you that count heads, we are all counted as part of the Office of the Chancellor. But you can see from the little chart here that half of my staff are located on college campuses spread throughout the system. A principle that puts us in close proximity to where decisions are made, that makes us much more effective and gains much better acceptance on the part of the colleges and universities that we interact with. And I should also point out that internal auditing is only part of our auditing solution at MinSKU. As Vice Chancellor King indicated, we hire certified public accounting firms to audit our financial statements, to audit for compliance with federal grant provisions, to audit our 12 largest universities and colleges, and we also hire the legislative auditor. Now, MinSKU is the only state agency that hires the legislative auditor at its own discretion, and we've had that relationship since the beginning of the organization, and we find it to be a very valuable addition to our audit arsenal. The legislative auditor reviews the the internal controls and compliance at 20 of our smaller colleges on a cyclical basis, and we embrace that as part of our audit program. My office tries to collaborate between CPA firms, the legislative auditor, and my office to make sure that we have, in fact, an efficient program. One of the more important duties of my office, and this is something I know the committee talked about last week, one of our more important duties in my mind is to follow up on known problems. We have a very systematic way of following up on audit findings that are delivered from any of those audit sources I mentioned, and we follow up on them very diligently to make sure that prompt, complete corrective action is taken. We don't simply accept someone's word that they have implemented a finding. We actually test it to make sure that it is in place. And the board and the chancellor value that service greatly. I will tell you that the board of trustees really have no tolerance for not implementing audit findings, and they insist that those findings be attended to. As a matter of fact, our audit committee, under the chairmanship of Trustee Fisk, has a hearing when there's any audit report that's issued by any of those audit entities that I mentioned. As a matter of fact, we just met earlier this month and heard the legislative auditor present his findings on the general obligation bond spending. The chancellor as well takes audit findings very seriously, and he takes it so far that he asks my office to report to him right before he does evaluations of the presidents and his senior administrators. He wants a report from me as to whether they have in fact implemented all of the prior audit findings. And if they haven't, those of you that know the chancellor know that he's a fairly no-nonsense guy, and there's a price to be paid. So, one final feature that I'll mention on internal auditing, then I'm going to close, Madam Chair, is that of adherence to professional standards. It's the fourth feature of internal auditing that really makes us special. Internal auditing standards now require that an internal auditing office have an external quality assurance review at least once every 5 years. And my office completed that in March of 2007. Other internal audit offices that have undergone such a review are the University of Minnesota, the Metropolitan Council, and the Minnesota Department of Transportation. It's a piece of any internal audit program that you should be insistent upon if you're going to expect that they deliver quality services. You should expect that they comply with standards and that they've undergone such a review. Madam Chair, with that, I would close and turn back to Vice Chancellor King for a few closing comments.
Okay. We want questions at this point, or we'll wait till Vice Chancellor King. Okay. Thank you, ma'am. Just to close here, I would repeat really my opening remarks, and that is that I came to you today to talk about how to create a financial management environment that has integrity. And internal audit is certainly one of the elements of what you need for that. They're a key part of the monitoring that's necessary to keep the message in the community that management and leadership is paying attention to these issues. The tone at the top is the most important. The work you're doing here today helps with that. Risk assessment is critical because the environment is constantly changing, and you'll hear from Chris Boozy and his colleagues today about the work going on in the Office of enterprise technology. That's a critical piece of the risk assessment. Environmental management. Control activities are important because as the work gets more mechanized, the control features get more and more important. Information and communication. We are large, all of us collectively. We are decentralized. And it's very important that people understand what the expectations are and what the protocols are. And then monitoring, which John mentioned. I would close really with just a couple of urgings. First of all, internal control is a process. It's not a state of being. It's a continual process. It's achieved with people. It's not achieved with machines or with forms. It's achieved with people and policy and leadership to pay attention to the people and to the process. I would urge you to have expectations only of reasonable assurance in keeping internal control and internal control discipline. And that's one of the things that that we've really, I think, worked hard to, and we've been advantaged in our environment because we have on our board several CPAs who understand the idea of reasonable assurance. You are not going to be able to manage an organization that has zero error. That's not a reasonable expectation. But you should have reasonable assurance that the risk mitigation and the exposure is acceptable by the standards you establish. And then finally, internal control is geared to objectives. It's very important to understand what risks you want to protect yourself against and the objectives behind the system that you design in order for it to produce the results that you want. I think those four concepts are really, really powerful as you think about this conversation in state government. I would urge you to look for assurances that the environment is properly conceived and reviewed, and note the caution that it's only reasonable assurance, that it's not reasonable to expect perfect assurance. And with that, Madam Chair, I would close, and John and I both would be open to any kind of questions or conversations you'd like to have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is one of the reports from the OLA from the 27th, and I heard you testify that all findings are fixed. So I'm assuming, and I have a couple follow-up questions, I'm assuming that these have all been taken care of.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, without going into John's tracking system, I can't give you absolute assurance that they've all been remedied. They all did get put into the tracking system, and John's folks are working with the campuses to get them resolved if they haven't already. Sometimes there's a technology explanation for why the finding was created. Sometimes it's a policy or a procedure explanation that falls to me to fix. So I couldn't in good faith say to you absolutely they're all fixed because I'm just seeing this today for the first time in some time. But we can find out and let you know.
I'd appreciate that. The second question is, and I think it is a core idea of good government to make sure that if you are audited that these issues get fixed. I mean, I think that's a no-brainer. We come through, we should have some follow-up, and I think that it's good we're having these conversations today so that we can establish that system. For example, once one of these auditor reports are issued, and maybe this is for you, Mr. Osmussen, I don't have my agenda in front of me, sorry. Right here. That how long does it take for these findings to be fixed, typically?
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, it's certainly, I give you the academic answer, and it depends, but I'll try to do a little bit better than that. I will tell you that our statistics tell us that 85 to 95% of them are all completely cleared within a year. And I would say that the majority of them are cleared within the first 6 months. Our follow-up cycle is to follow up at mid-year, which is about now. So we are in the process of sending follow-up reports out to all of our presidents right now. And But that generally creates a little urgency if there is something that's unresolved. They know that within 6 months they'll be facing the chancellor on the performance review, and so they want things to be corrected before that happens. Now, on that 85%, the ones that are not implemented timely are usually the more foundational issues that would require either some kind of a policy change or a system change that has to stay on the docket for some period of time. But they don't go away. They stay on our follow-up system, and we dog them until they have been resolved. One other category that takes a while to resolve is some of our federal issues, because we have to wait for the U.S. Department of Education to correspond back to us to clear the findings, and that may take a couple of years. Which is obviously outside of your jurisdiction to control the federal government. So that's just kind of a general idea, Madam Chair.
Representative Bingham. Thank you. And then my final question is, I think you quoted the Chancellor as a no-nonsense kind of guy, but what does happen if, say, some of these systemic and I guess maybe this is a good point to ask you too, are some of these reoccurring? But if there is a reoccurring or a systemic problem, if something isn't fixed, what are the ramifications? Is there disciplinary action to the president of the university, let's just say, or college? Or maybe is there a financial impact where maybe some money isn't given for something? I guess I'm looking to you to be a little more specific on the ramifications of that.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, I'd be happy to respond to that. The Chancellor has an annual review cycle and performance goals established for each of the presidents. And as the review cycle is coming forward, the senior staff produce information about our areas as relates to that campus. And part of that is the work John does. Part of it is the work that's done in academic and student affairs, and et cetera. I would be surprised if there was any instance where there was an audit finding that sat on the president's list for more than a year. Once they get in front of the chancellor, if the finding's on the list at that point, it's gone by the next year. This is a very high threshold expectation. There are some issues that sometimes evolve to a personnel issue on the campuses. And then we will work with the president to resolve that. It might mean reassignment. It might mean staff training. It might mean replacement, which has happened in some of the financial management offices across the state over the years. So the consequence really is felt by the president in the performance review process. And we have found it to be a very responsive loop.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Asmussen. We're glad to have you here today, glad to hear these things. I thought it was interesting, though, with even all of the efforts that you have made, still, you know, you have some of these findings, and some of them cost money. And so I thought your reasonable assurance is more appropriate than, and especially for us legislators, keep in mind that zero in perfection is a hard thing to get. And so I think there is, within that scope. But probably more than anything, I believe in prevention when you can. If you put this much effort into this, internal auditing is wonderful, but that's an after the fact, and you don't want to depend upon that. What do you do up front in regards to employees that you bring in? What is it that you do in the beginning that's that culture, the chancellor's impact, that the finance mechanics and all of these things that enable you? Because really, ultimately, that will dictate somewhat your findings, is because of what you do up front. That's what we're really interested in knowing about.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. That's 90% of victory, is how you enter into it. We have spent a lot of time on job descriptions and position descriptions and search procedures. I personally am involved in all the CFO hiring that happens on the campuses, to make sure that I'm satisfied that we're hiring people with the right skills and attributes. We provide training on the accounting system, the payroll system, on policies and procedures.
We have sort of a community of newcomers that we have put together so that people know who they can get in touch with, and we pay special attention. Depending upon what the role and responsibility is, we pay special attention in different ways the first couple of years. We have an exception reporting process that monitors whether or not the campus is completing its basic control cycles adequately and timely, and that's an early alert for us. And then we will reach out and see what's happening on the campus and try to get folks back on track sooner. We also have a group of the campus financial management folks meet several times a year on an agenda that they design to work through issues that they're interested in more development on or more input on. So I would say we don't do enough training. I think we do a fair amount of it. But because we're so spread out, we've used technology more and more in the last couple of years for more training opportunities. But there's always a desire to do more. One thing that we have instituted just in the last 2 years, I think, is the code of conduct, which I saw referenced in some material that the executive branch, I don't think, has installed yet. And this requires the finance officers and the business managers and the chief accountants at each of the campuses to sign a certification that goes along with their financial management, their financial data, about full disclosure and accuracy and reliability and the usual due diligence. That has, and the president signs that as well. And that has also contributed to really ratcheting up the attention and the leadership that we get off the campus in this area, because we're asking them to put their name on it. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, and Vice Chancellor, I appreciate that. I suspected that might be the case, but I really wanted to hear that. One follow-up question to that is, when you go through all that, do you have a, what do you do with employees that maybe in your methodology aren't meeting that standard or those expectations? How do you deal with that? Because you've got union employees that have tenure and you have a variety of other things going on. How do you deal with it when standards are not being met or followed?
Madam Chair, Representative Schiffmeyer, it depends upon their placement in the organization. If they're administrators, at-will employees, which most of our chief financial officers or business managers are, that gives us one avenue of response. If they're AFSCME or MAPE, then that gives us a different avenue. But we've had good fortune, and we put good effort into training and coaching and tracking, and we're very high performers in the evaluation process. So that has not been a barrier for us.
Okay. The next person is represented on the list is Representative Winkler, but just kind of, she's sort of hearing a buzzing. So if anyone has a cell phone on, would they please turn it off? Even if it can't even be silent, it needs to be off in this room. So
even if it's, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, even if it's on vibrate or silent.
Right. There's some interference. And Representative Polberg, I just noticed on your, the symbol on your Pepsi is kind of identical to the Obama symbol.
Madam Chair, I read an article, it took him $1 million to come up with this.
And Obama just took it from them and put it in the O.
Obama, $600 million.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on a couple of things that Mr. Asperson was discussing with us. In a summary fashion, what I took from your presentation was that good internal controls result from management priority or good management practices, some kind of internal audit function to follow up on that, as well as good policies, risk assessment, and a deliberate approach to identifying where potential problems could lie. And then I think about some of your recommendations from the legislature's point of view, which is what can we do except to shine a light on what's happening or not happening, and secondarily to mandate certain policies or procedures or functions. We can't change the management priority. We can't create a good tone at the top for agencies, really, except by asking them hard questions, which may make them more motivated to set the right tone, which is, I think, part of what we're doing here. But I just looked at this list that Mr. Nobles provided us last week of the state agencies with internal audit offices, and the list does not include, just off the top of my head, the PCA, the Department of Finance, Department of Administration, Dolly D, the Department of Health, the Department of Public Safety, or the Department of Education. That's 8 major agencies without any kind of internal audit staff. So first of all, I guess the question would be, should large agencies have that kind of function? And the second question is, you said that small agencies, boards, or commissions shouldn't necessarily have internal audit functions because it might not be economical. At the same time, the Department of Finance shouldn't provide that. So where should, to the degree they have need some kind of internal audit, even if it's only a small amount, where should that come from, I guess is the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I would commend for your consideration the North Carolina study that I referenced as one way to look at it, and I'm sure Commissioner Hansen is considering this question more widely. Although, having said that, right now there's not a obligation in state law that the Commissioner of Finance is responsible for internal auditing. There's a statute that provides that the Commissioner of Finance can set standards for internal auditing, but as I indicated, there are already professional standards, so that doesn't really need much legislation, in my view. The states that have taken this on have taken an approach where they will look at major agencies and suggest they have an internal audit function. It's not unlike the approach the federal government has taken with the Inspector General's Act, which may be something else you want to take a look at as a possible model, although it's a lot more extensive than I think we want to get into here in Minnesota. But then when you get to the smaller agencies, backing up, I will tell you that if any agency is going to have an internal audit function, they've got to be committed to it. And I told you earlier that if the chancellor and the board chair were not committed to internal auditing, I wouldn't be here. And I just don't think, I think it's a little delicate to mandate the agencies that they establish it. They've got to see the need and the value. Now, what the internal auditing function is trying to get at, again, is that end game of effective internal control. And so there's not necessarily something missing in a small agency if they don't have an audit function themselves. They have to, the key is they have to be able to carry out some monitoring activities. Now, they could seek that from other sources. It could be some, they can do self-assessments, for example. The Department of Finance has developed checklists that smaller agencies could carry out and try to make a self-determination on as to whether they have appropriate controls or not. They could do, they could possibly do things on a more collaborative basis where they could get together and exchange ideas or do some kind of peer analysis. The Department of Finance could go out and do some consultation with them, but it would fall short of being the full-fledged audit function, but still achieve that monitoring end. I've helped my clarity here or not.
Well, no, I'm sure you have. I mean, I think your point about there being, I guess your first answer was mandating an internal audit office, even for a large agency, may not be a useful exercise if the agency itself doesn't see the need and want to establish it. And then I guess the question would be, what do you do for these big agencies that don't appear to have this kind of... I mean, you're not saying that it wouldn't be effective or useful or important that they have that. You're saying it's a good idea, but if they don't buy into it, the legislature can't do a lot about it. And that leads me to the only thing that we can really do then is to provide some light on the fact that they don't have it, and that might be part of that they're missing out on good practices. Are there other things that you can think of that the legislature might be able to do to improve the management priority for good control?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitler, you talked about this earlier, and that's asking the tough questions. Make them answer the questions of how do they assess their internal controls, how do they monitor their internal controls effectiveness, and if they don't have a good answer to that, I mean, you could, you know, push them toward internal auditing as a possible solution. But that's the end game that they're trying to get to, is to have good answers to those questions about effect to control. The other thing that, in our case, I think has worked very effectively, and that is that require a certification from the agency head and from the finance people. And so the agency head certification is different than the certification from the finance people. The agency head basically has to certify that they understand that their agency has an effective system of internal control as well as reliable information. Now, in order for them to sign that, most of them are going to have to go to their finance people or someplace where they're going to be motivated to create an internal audit department in order to give them the assurance they need to even make the signature on that piece of paper.
Madam Chair, I guess the follow-up is, yes, we can ask the tough questions, but as you point out, in state statute, we have assigned the Commissioner of Finance part of that duty, which is to coordinate, maintain standards, and then to report on the status of that internal audit function in state government.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Whitmer, this is a little bit off our brief here, so...
Well, I'm asking for your good advice based on your success.
Yes, I appreciate that. And I think that you're on the right
track. For Jim Nobles, we don't often have someone who's had 20 years' experience in his office before
and isn't directly under him at this point. So it's a unique opportunity. And one to take advantage of, because John brings great experience.
I know that you didn't let him come alone, but that's okay. That's all right.
I understand there's a very healthy skepticism for authority, though.
I think you're on the right track, Representative Winkler. In the correspondence I saw to the Commissioner of Finance and the answer back, this is really a governance and a management structure conversation between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And John's reference to the North Carolina study shows that they worked out how they wanted to do this between the two branches of government. But I think the conversation really rests with the Commissioner of Finance. Our urging to you is that the conversation be in the context of a framework which recognizes the principles of internal control and sets as a standard, not absolute assurance, but reasonable assurance. So I would say only that I think in the end this is going to have to be find its natural balance between the two branches.
Okay. Representative
Winkler's question.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor King, you started off your presentation by talking about internal controls needing a high-level champion.
Mm-hmm.
And that really rung true for me. I think that we've heard a series of challenges in lots of different state agencies, and I think the legislature has our high-level champion in Auditor Nobles. On the other branch, I'm going to be spending some time following up on the North Carolina study and learning more about lessons that they learned. But I'm wondering if you might be able to comment on the strengths and liabilities of Governor Pawlenty bringing on a very high level. Clearly, we don't have that champion either from the bully pulpit or internally to bring on a very well-known, I'm using the phrase a superstar, but somebody who can really bring attention that this is a high priority for the executive branch, that the buck is going to stop here. That I have a very healthy fear of the lieutenant governor, certainly when it comes to arm wrestling, and probably if I was in her within the crosshairs, you know, I think that that may be an appropriate role for that office. I know the chair has considered, contemplated getting rid of the lieutenant governor, but I think that that may be something where we want to codify some real responsibility. I'm just sort of looking to you both for thoughts and guidance on a very specific instrument we might be able to use, whether it's the lieutenant governor's office or someone else bringing on as we contemplate this year.
Well, as you know, just Representative Kalin, somebody once thought that that was a good job for the treasurer to do, and we got rid of that one too. So,
so I thought one would wipe out. It would be my judgment as a former state finance commissioner that role belongs with the finance commissioner. That is the person charged with the integrity of the financial management information for the state. So I think it would be suboptimal to split it out and create another function. And I go back to sort of the context here, and that is that this is about the environment. It's about a process. It's about creating a culture of excellence in financial management in all of its facets. And so I don't think it would be successful to simply task someone with being in charge of internal control, because they'd be trying to push a bus uphill at that point. I think it goes to the larger leadership question. And to that, I think this committee has a role in setting the tone, and I think the commissioners have a role in setting the tone, each of the commissioners. John's reference to the certification is a little tricky because of the way the state does financial reporting, but I think you could solve that problem if someone gave some thought to lining up the responsibilities and accountabilities.
Now that the budget is available before us, I urge all members to look at the first few pages of the Department of Finance's budget, and it was either an example of mind reading or some very fast editing after our hearing last week, because it looks very much along the lines of what's being suggested. Although when you look at what the trade-offs are, it's not exactly clear how it'll work. But anyway, I urge people to read those. I think it's just the first few pages into the Department of Finance's budget.
Well, and Madam Chair, this committee can help as well, because coming before you every year are requests for staffing or recommendations for budget cuts. And so one of the questions you should pursue is, how does this impact the integrity of your environment? Because that should be one of your concerns.
Madam Chair, it looks like Mr. Ostenson might have had a thought as well. Do we have time to hear?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Kell, I would again commend the North Carolina study as an alternative model. In North Carolina's case, I believe they put together a kind of an oversight group that included their Commissioner of Finance, their Attorney General, a few other state higher level ranking state officials, and so they had. But it was not to manage the internal controls; it was to be that channel for overseeing the implementation of effective controls. Thank you.
Okay, Representative
Simon. Here, I think all my questions but one have already been asked and answered, so thanks. I just have one, which is, what would be wrong, in your view, I guess this is for Mr. Esmussen, well, for both of you, actually, what would be wrong with a MNSCU model for state government, where the Department of Finance, or MMD now, would be like MNSCU is, as to the campuses, and that the agencies, with respect to internal auditing, would be like the campuses? Do you think that would work, or is that not a one-size-fits-all approach?
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, I think it would work to a very large extent. It has most of the elements you need. It has the accountabilities lined up between the financial information and the financial management system. It has all of the accountable parties according to one chief executive, so you'd have the capacity to exercise leadership and communication from that standpoint. So I think most of it would work.
The challenge that it places is that governors have a lot going on besides worrying about internal controls. So you need to think about how to line up the oversight part of it. Maybe it would report to a chief of staff, or there'd be somebody else in the governor's office that was tasked particularly. The argument against it is that, again, this is not a 24-month cycle objective. This is something you invest time in for years and years and years and years. And so there needs to be some institutional memory and some continuity, and you'd want to think about how to install that. But I think most of the elements are there for it to be successful.
Okay.
Okay. Steve, you want anything else?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the one thing that I would suggest you might want to consider as well for the model that you have in mind is some reporting channel to the legislative branch as well. Now, it could be through Mr. Noble's office. It could be the kind of inspector general model where they're required to submit periodic reports to the Congress. But that gives you the channel back to the governance body as well as the executive branch. And in my view, you need both to have an effective internal audit function, both reporting to the governing body and to the executive management body.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to kind of get back to, I think, more of the Minshew process. Representative Kiffmeyer talked about setting the expectations and kind of laying it out to begin with and making sure that when people come in that you kind of know what the role is. But I'm wondering about how does Minshew use the internal auditors to manage those expectations, and what kind of role would the auditors see as helping them manage the expectations? So it's you know, you hear about it and you know that it's going to be, but just to manage it.
Madam Chair, Representative Poppe, one of the real fruits of our relationship with the legislative auditor and the tenure we have with John's leadership is that we have worked together to articulate our expectations around roles and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so when we get work products from the legislative auditor with findings and concerns that they raise, we have a real serious discussion about where that concern should be rested. And that's tremendously valuable because those documents go out into the rank and file and are used by business managers trying to sort out their organizational chart. So we do it at that level, really. And then as processes change or technologies change, John's people are available to the campuses to go back and check and see if there's a gap that's opened up in the environment as a result of some process change. And then that communication goes around to all the campuses. So it's a very sort of vibrant channel that runs both through the auditor staff, through the finance staff, and through the legislative auditor staff. And in that way, I think we've kept pretty well ahead of it, I think. So far. One thing that goes to this institutional memory issue is that's been beneficial to us is that if John keeps track of the findings and we classify them in terms of their materiality and can chart for us the nature and kind of findings that are coming in from the legislative auditor's work over the years, and the number has gone down and the severity has gone down really steadily over the last 8 years. And that gives our board assurance that, sure, things are going to get found and they get fixed. And there's no big, large material opening. So to John's suggestion that there be a reporting loop from the executive to the legislative, that would be one thing you'd want to watch for, is the sort of classification of results over the years. In reading the reports I've seen from the legislative auditor over the last year or so, it's a little hard to tell. Are these one-off events, or is, notwithstanding the headline that was in the newspaper this weekend, are these one-off events that we want to be found and we send auditors out to find, or is it a tip of an iceberg thing? And I don't think you can tell by the work that's been done so far. Just so that would help that.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments or questions from any members? Okay, is there anyone who didn't read the article in Sunday's paper, and do you need a copy of it? Just we'll get it to you. Okay. Okay, any last comments or questions? Okay, we'll be ready for the Commissioner of Finance on Thursday. And I'm sorry. we do have one other person on there. On the list.
From OEC.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Mr. Booth.
Madam Chair, committee member, I thought I lost the hook there for a minute.
Oh. two alert staff people to let that happen. Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, first off, I'd like to thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. To go back a couple years, it was actually this very committee, as well as your counterparts in the Minnesota Senate, that actually created our enterprise security program back in July 2006, actually when I was first brought on as the state's first chief information security officer. Prior to that time, I spent about 20 years working with legislative auditor Jim Noble, both as a certified public accountant and leading the group that spearheaded all the detailed technology and security audits for the state of Minnesota, essentially serving as the eyes and ears of the legislature in that area. So coming into the position as the state's first chief information security officer, I was well aware of the types of security challenges that we faced. In fact, I had a lot of reservations about taking the job after seeing the beast firsthand and spending so much time out in the state agencies. But we really had a couple of different questions coming into this position. First of all, from a security perspective, how do you go about crafting a security program for something as large as a state government, a $50 billion organization? And secondly, given the state that our government was in, with approximately 100 different siloed entities, how do we ever get to the point where we can make enterprise-wide decisions, something that we actually needed to have in order to achieve some of the security goals that we need to achieve and actually remedy some of the problems that you get to read about in the different legislative audit reports, most of which that I actually personally got a chance to pen over the prior 10 years. So I thought I would start by being deductive, and I wanted to give you a little bit of then versus now. So if we look back at July 2006 and we compare that to where we are today, we started off with a model where every individual government entity acted with complete independence. They ran their IT, security was an issue that they actually had to deal with on their own on a case-by-case basis. They did the best that they could with the staff that they have, but by and large, what you all know from reading the legislative audit report is that the problems that entities face are simply too complicated, too technical, and too expensive for the entities to address on their own one by one. In fact, one of the last chances that I got to testify before the legislature for the audit commission, it was after we had written the report on the Department of Public Safety and we made the recommendation that they just simply shut down motor vehicle licensing because it was just too risky the way it was crafted. At that time, the chair of the audit commission asked me to really summarize what do all these different audit reports mean. And Jim Nobles and I spent some time talking about that, and ultimately we came back with the phrase that we were doing too much, we had too much technology scattered across too many organizations with not enough planning and leadership. And that really sums up where we started back in July 2006. Today, I'm proud to report that the Office of Enterprise Technology provides statewide leadership for information security And I think one of the most important things that we did, in fact, I started in July of 2006, one of the very first things that I did is through our policy setting authority, which you gave us in our enabling legislation, what we created, we used our first policy to create what's called the State's Information Security Council. And what this is an advisory body to myself and to Gopal Khanna, the state's CIO, to help us figure out what the enterprise security program really needs to do and how it actually needs to do it. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail as we go along. But essentially, since this is a talk about governance, the way I view the Information Security Council is I put that body in place because I felt like I needed to have a board of directors that represented the whole government. So the way I look at the Security Council when I meet with those folks is about 50 people that show up from across the government, not only the state government, but different branches of government and county folks are involved as well in this organization. And I look at those folks and I think of them as my board of directors. Every single dollar that you've appropriated to our organization to use for enterprise security, as well as every security decision that we make, I feel like I need to be able to look at those folks straight in the eye and say, did I make a good decision? So that's the value of the Information Security Council. Over the past 2.5 years, one of the things that we've undertaken is we've put together an enterprise security strategic plan. It's a 5-year roadmap to take us from where we are today with I guess I'd have to say, inept security controls in many cases, to the point where we ultimately all believe that we need to be as a community 5 years from now. There are over 20 agencies that participated in this year-long effort to put our first strategic plan in place, and I believe that we're one of only 5 states in the nation that have such a plan for enterprise security. We've also worked to put a program foundation in place, and by that I mean there's several widely recognized models that are used, one for the private sector that's put forth by an international standard organization. And there's one that's put together for government that's largely used by government organizations, by the National Institutes of Standard and Technology. And we've adopted the NIST model as the model that we're going to use to build our enterprise security program. The reason why that's important is that when we go out and we try to build a car, it's important for us to understand what the end state is going to look like. And people need to understand that we're building something towards an industry-recognized model. In addition, there's a lot of talk right now on the national level to mandate a lot of the federal security controls, namely it's called FISMA, down to the individual states. And if that actually comes to fruition, I want to place the Minnesota state government in a position where we will be compliant with FISMA just by the very nature of the way we structured our program. And finally, one of the things...
Can you say again what that acronym is?
FISMA. It's the Federal Information Security Management Act.
Okay.
And finally, one of the things that I think was really important for me when I chose to take on this job as the state's Chief Information Security Officer, I saw some of the prior policy offices that existed before the Office of Enterprise Technology. One of the things that was very important for me to take on this job is I did not want to come into a position where I was a policy guy. I didn't want to put out blind policies without actually helping the government craft solutions. So along with setting the bar, the policy type stuff of where we needed to go, I also thought it was really important to put in real solutions that made our government more secure. And that's the area where governance comes most into play. So looking at government, when we talk about security service development, the goal that we have is to develop best-of-breed security solutions that can be shared. Sharing is something that's very important to us. Today, under our model, it's a world of haves and have-nots. There's some of the agencies that have a lot of federal money that actually do a fairly decent job with their information security, but that doesn't do a lot of good to the rest of the government that largely has nothing in place. We need to start thinking of our environment as the state of Minnesota, not as the Department of Human Services and the Department of Public Safety. We are the state of Minnesota, and we need to be secure as a state. The Information Security Council is very important in helping us achieve that goal because when we're looking at solutions, the specific types of technologies that we're going to deploy as well as how we're going to do it, the Security Council serves as the advisor on all solutions. It's not the Office of Enterprise Technology, it's the security community solution. So they're the advisor, and to go one step further than that, the Information Security Council, through subcommittees that we create, actually assists the Office of Enterprise Technology with the development of the solutions, the selection of products, and actually the operation of those products. To give you a few examples, in your handout, I'm not planning to run through all of these examples, but I put on the list a couple of the non-technical type of things that we've put in place already today, as well as some very technical things. And I wanted to talk briefly about one technical solution that we have in place, because it truly is the foundation of the Enterprise Security Program, and that is vulnerability and threat management. The goal that we have with vulnerability and threat management is to find and fix problems with all government computer systems before they can be exploited by people with bad intent. It's a pretty daunting challenge. Collectively, we estimate across state government that we have about 50,000 computers that fall under our domain. We also, in the Enterprise Security Program, we partner very closely with Minsky, and we feel that Minsky has about 100,000 additional endpoints that we need to worry about. So what we've done with vulnerability and threat management, we've defined as a community what needs to be done, but we've also installed and are now operating what I think is the best state-of-the-art solution, and we've installed, we're managing this once across two central data centers that are managed by five members of my team, but it's a solution that's used by every government agency to actually do ongoing scans of government computer systems. So it's important for government entities that in most organizations, ultimately, we see ongoing daily scanning and assessments of every government computer system with this powerful tool so that we can find problems, but more importantly, so we can fix those problems immediately before they're taken advantage of by hackers and people with bad intent. Along with working inside individual government agencies and their secure networks, another thing that I think is really important to you as policymakers is we're also trying to leverage our solutions to do more than just deal with executive branch agencies and higher ed. One of the services that we rolled out this month is that for every single customer that's a customer of the Office of Enterprise Technology, which includes school districts, counties, cities, lots of local government entities that you represent, if you're a customer of OET and you get your connectivity through OET, one of the things that we're going to be doing by default, because we're going to leverage this tool, is we're going to provide ongoing monthly assessments of all of the external face of government. So if you're McLeod County and you have a problem with one of your web servers and we find that problem, you can expect to get reports from us and you can expect to get calls from us. It's the right thing to do, particularly since we've invested a lot of money in this solution. It's incumbent on us to find ways to use that money to help all of the citizens and government entities, not just those that fall, quote, underneath our executive branch framework. So vulnerability and threat management, it's one of the foundational things that we're putting in place right now. It's very important. There's a lot of wins right now because the things that we're finding and fixing are the things that keep government entities out of the news today. If you've got a chance to read USA Today, one of the top items on USA Today was about one of the most serious computer worms has been released that we've seen since, I believe, 2004. One of the things that we did using our tool, which is called IP360, is we've helped agencies assess their environments for the vulnerability to that particular worm, and we also proactively, and this was actually the very day that this outbreak happened, we had immediate notification and instructions out to all government entities, the executive branch, everybody who participates in the Security Council, on how to fix their computers. So today we have a worm that impacted millions of computers worldwide, but we've had very, very, very insignificant and inconsequential things that happened to the state of Minnesota. So that's one of the demonstrable things that you can see by having an enterprise program that has a proactive approach with good people and tools. On the policy development side, we've also been working on trying to figure out what is the appropriate baseline security for government as a whole. All of the policies, though, and all of the standards that we're creating, that were created, are developed by subject matter experts, and they're actually assessed and they're built through the Information Security Council, the primary foundation of enterprise security governance. But one thing that's different with policies is that in addition to being developed and managed and run within the security community itself, we also route those kind of documents through a broader governance process, which is used by the Office of Enterprise Technology for most technology needs, such as the new enterprise email system. But essentially what happens is the policies and standards are routed to all the chief information officers for review and comment. They're also run through the commissioners of the government agencies and approved through the Commissioners Technology Advisory Board. And ultimately, after it's run through the governance process, which at a minimum takes 100 days, they're signed by Gopal Khanna, the state CIO, and they become official policy. That is how we implement the process that you gave us in state law, the policy setting authority for the security community. To date, we have 9 important security policies that have went through the process. I'm not planning to run through the different policies that are listed there, but each one of them, I think, has its own level of importance. Some of them are very broad, others are very tactical. To give you an example, we have an enterprise-wide policy on portable computing devices. I think one of the interesting things that happened is my very first day that I started, and I joined the executive branch as the state chief information security officer, my first day was spent dealing with the 5 o'clock news with lost and stolen laptops. And in my first week, I had a couple of those examples where government data was being exposed on lost and stolen laptops. One of the things that we did with our Security Council immediately is we put in place a very powerful policy and standard for portable computing devices. And essentially it says this: data that's classified as not public data under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act should not be stored on portable computing devices unless it absolutely has to for a justifiable business need. Second cut, if that data is stored on those devices, it has to be encrypted. Now, going beyond just the policy guy, our security community worked and established an enterprise-wide contract with one of the, we vetted all the different security solutions that could meet this need. We entered into a contract with a company called PointSec, which is now owned by the Checkpoint Corporation. We have a very, very phenomenal deal, which government agencies can use to purchase the solution at a fraction of what it would cost them to go out and do this on their own. We also have that solution available. We structured the contract so counties and cities and other units of government can purchase and take advantage of that as well. We provide ongoing training on the use of the product. We have community listservs and lots of other ways that we can make this solution really hum in our environment. The bottom line today is I believe we have about 25,000 laptops across the state of Minnesota that are encrypted, and that's one of the reasons why you don't read about this stuff in the news like you used to, because I think we have our ducks in a row in this particular area. So in conclusion, I think the key point that I want to make today is that security challenges today that we face are very significant, and they really only can be solved with a collaborative approach of multiple government agencies. The problems are just too big, they're too complicated, and they're too costly. There's not enough money that the legislature can throw at this problem agency by agency to solve the problem. There's a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done. I'll be the first to admit that. You're going to find that out in about a month when Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles releases the audit report on small agency security services. You're going to find that we have a lot of problems. But the point today is that we understand the issues, and I think we're going down the road to make progress to addressing those issues. And we've made a tremendous amount of progress in the 2.5 years that we've been working in this area. And I hope as the legislative body that actually ponied up the money and helped us with the idea to make it happen. I hope that in the future you give us an opportunity to come back and demonstrate how we're giving you return on investment, not only for the executive branch, but for other units of government across the state as well. Before concluding, I'd like to thank you once again for giving us the opportunity to testify for a brand new function in government, and actually my first stint working in the executive branch of government. Given the opportunity to come and talk about a good governance process, I really consider it quite an honor, to be honest, and especially to have my former boss, Jim Noble, you know, recommend that we come and talk about some of the things that we're doing. Though we have some successes in our area, I'm not here to tell you it's a success story. We'll be a success story if we actually take some of the things we're doing and we truly institutionalize it and the governance process long-term works, so that the things we do are things that get embedded across all government entities and we break down the silo mentality that we have today. If that happens, we will not only have individual successes, but we will truly be a success story. With that, I'd be willing to take any comments that folks have.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Busey. If you think about the COSO framework that the Department of Finance has adopted for internal controls and internal audit broadly, there's a chunk of that that's oriented towards IT controls. Is what you're doing actually contributing to internal audit in the agencies that are performing it, or is your kind of IT and security function really separate and distinct and the two aren't collaborating?
Madam Chair, committee members, I would like to say that that's a tough question to answer, and I come with 20 years of audit background and a CPA, and that's still a tough question to answer. But the fact of the matter is, I think a key point that that John Osmussen mentioned is that installing controls in an organization is the responsibility of management. Becoming and accepting my new role in the executive branch means that I am management. I am one of the people that is supposed to make sure we have the right controls in government and that those controls actually work. The buck has to stop here when you look at it from a computer security standpoint. Now, where it links with the audit function is that whether they're doing technology audits or financial audits that rely on our financial systems, one of the things that we can do is that when they want to come in and look at the new MAP system or whatever type of process they're looking at, they should be able to come to us and they should say, okay, under the COSO framework, we have a communication part, we have a monitoring part, we have an internal control definition part, and I should be able to say, here's how we're accomplishing that in our environment. And I should be able to provide them with evidence to show them that, in fact, it truly does happen. So that's where I think we come into play. An example of this is when I worked for Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles, one of the things that we did as auditors is we went into environments and we did a lot of detailed scanning of the IT environments trying to find exploitable vulnerabilities. The reason why we did that is because the government entities didn't do it themselves. If they actually had an effective vulnerability and threat management program like we think we could put in place today, and we could demonstrate to the auditors that, you know what, if you're coming in and looking at OET, you don't need to do your own detailed scanning. We scan our environment 3 times per day. Here's the evidence. Here's how we started when we started going down this path. Here's the problems we have. Here's what we fixed. And here's our risk posture today. So I think if we do our homework right on the management side, it should result in less audit effort because they should be able to examine, maybe replicate some of the things that we do, but then rely on the controls that we put in place as management.
And I guess the question is that happening today? And you can just give a yes, no kind of answer. I'm just looking for a broad generalization as to how mature you are in that function.
You can say sometimes.
Yeah,
maybe.
Sometimes.
The answer is sometimes.
Okay.
You know, when you look at things like our ability to manage vulnerabilities and threats, we're starting to get on the road of doing a good job. There's other security areas where I can honestly say that I think we get a D. So I can't give you an honest yes. Hopefully someday, if we implement our strategic plan, I can come back and give you a yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fair answer is all I was looking for. Okay. Thank you. Yep.
Representative Winkler, first, I want to make one comment on one of my decisions on the security issue. My license plates had to be renewed right at the time when that motor vehicle thing was open. And so, of course, you know, wanting to be a techie, I went to go look at it online, only to discover that there was an extra charge for doing it. So my essential sickness overruled the desire for experimentation. So I went down and got it the way I usually do. So it shows that basic instincts always work out well. Ryan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should have done this when Minsky was here, but I just want to compliment you on being a leader in what you're doing, in basically being assigned a task and deciding that you're going to do it well and to think about it and to assemble what you need to do it. And this, I think maybe this is the training that Jim Nobles gave you and to Mr. Asmussen at Minsky. But what he said was, you have a job to do even if you don't have a lot of money. Even in tight budgets, you still have a job to do, and it's your responsibility to find a way to do it. And I think that, at least from what I saw from Minsky and from you, you're doing it, and you are doing it as well as you can. And when you're falling short or where you're not as far as you want to be, you're not defensive but straightforward about the need to do it. I really appreciate that. We don't hear that enough in committees when we hear from agencies. And I think it's a set of questions we can ask the Commissioner of Finance as well. There is no reason why the Department of Finance couldn't be taking that same kind of leadership role. And I expect that as a result, hopefully, some of these hearings, they may be more dedicated to doing so.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. And Jim Nobles is definitely a mentor that I'll always look up to.
I did observe that every time Jim Nobles really compliments somebody, it's somebody he's trained. Representative Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. An observation about the success, I think for the committee as much as for Mr. Ducey or Bucci, I think. Ducey, right?
Bucci.
Excuse me, I thought I had the first compliment right. But I think that some of it is attitude and personality. And sort of competence and training, but I do think that the kind of inner structural lesson is about an interagency kind of center that where the responsibilities have been able to, there's been liaisons and opportunities and engagement, buy-in by the different state agencies, but that the theme of a specific task that reaches across. I actually have a proposal in a totally different area that I think fits the same theme that we're seeing even large universities turn themselves inside out and be less about the colleges and little schools, but about the centers and the opportunities out there. I think that this may be an opportunity as we talk about reform and savings and effectiveness in state government.
Okay. Last comment from Representative Kitzmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Over our time. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lucas. I think what really struck me here, and I think for us, you know, I agree, Representative Kalin, in looking at these models, whether it's North Carolina or something else like that, but I think it was the tone and the attitude. If we take a gotcha approach, agencies will run and hide, and you'll never accomplish it. If you do it a, you know, patronizing, lorded over kind of thing, again, it doesn't. But what I've sensed both in Minsky and in the OET was an attitude they had about set the bar, improve competency, help with limited resources, you know, bake security into new systems, find and fix, limit damage, prevent. You know, their tone is really, I thought, well established in what they said here. And I think we in the legislature, too, in taking that approach, that believing that these state government employees want to do well, agencies want to do well. And but if we do a gotcha, that's really tough for anybody to take. And I think I've seen that that's been the key both in Minsky and in the OET, and again, commend you for that, and thank you for giving us some good examples so that, you know, we can kind of look at that for some threads. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any last comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, I almost forgot you. Anyway, meeting adjourned. I'm well. We had a